I'm Cape.
And I'm Drew.
We're just two former student athletes who understand the game.
Not just on the court.
But in life.
At the end of the day, we just want to help.
Today's athletes and former just trying to find their way.
It's bigger than sports.
This is the Cape and Drew Podcast, the real TikTok. What's up, everybody? I'm Cape.
I'm Drew, and we are back today, everybody, with part three of our four-part series of See Black Women. Just wanted to highlight some exceptional things that Black women are doing just across the country, and we've been able to reach out to some exceptional people. And so today we're fortunate to have the Executive Vice President and COO of Howard University, Ms. Dr. Tashani Ann DuBroy. So how are you doing today, Dr. DuBroy?
I am doing well, Drew. Julian, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
We definitely appreciate you, you know, taking the time to be on here. We know it's a lot going on. We all work in higher ed, so we know like these meetings, they can kind of take on a life of their own. So we definitely just want to thank you for just carving out some time for us.
No problem at all. Yep, I think we are all zoomed out. We're facing the same thing.
So the first question we like to ask our guests is, how are you doing during this COVID-19 pandemic, and what's been the best part of quarantine, and what's been the worst part?
Well, thanks for asking. So I am doing well. I've got a little 11-year-old daughter who I've had to ensure, you know, she has all kinds of things to do. So I've had to keep on engaging her, especially as we went on lockdown. She had a lot of online work to be completed. And after her 1 hour of school ended, it was just, you know, a mommy and me type of situation. And so I had to find new ways to engage her, because as you can imagine, she was missing her friends and was very bored. So I think that's been the most satisfying part of the pandemic. It's just getting the opportunity to be with my family. And then I love cooking. So for a moment there, I was cooking 3 times a day. It was getting ridiculous. I had to transition to breakfast and dinner only. You know, everybody did a cold lunch. And I think right now, the sleeping patterns have changed. So she's sleeping through breakfast and grabbing her own brunch. And now I'm just back to doing dinner. So we're trying to develop this as a sense of normalcy around here.
Gardening. You're training early for the brunch life, I see.
Exactly. Doing a bit of gardening, that brings fulfillment. You know, you got to find other things to do, and of course, exercise. So I don't like the gym, but I like being athletic. So playing tennis, playing golf. Mm. I think everybody's trying to adapt in their own way. And I've been, you know, trying to keep our minds engaged and enjoying family time.
It's so crazy. Cape and I were in this run club, and then I just ordered like a home gym basically off of Amazon. Like, even if the gym opened up right now, I was like, I'm still not going back.
Exactly. That's right. I think I did the same thing. Ordered a few weights and, you know, doing a few things at the house.
You definitely have to be creative.
Push-ups and sit-ups I can do anymore before I'm just like, what in the world, and running miles. I mean, like Drew said, we try to run as many miles we can a month, but it's, you know, it's good though, because we're trying to maintain this healthy lifestyle and be healthy. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know if I'll ever get a gym membership again. I don't know.
I know. It's a long time down the road, especially for me to feel comfortable.
Yeah. We just give each other like I Am Legend quotes like just every day as far as like just how we're feeling, because it's just like that's just basically how our mood is. Like, man, I don't know when this is gonna end.
But hilarious.
Something I always kind of kept up with you about. So can you tell us a little bit about your transition from being, you know, a research scientist at ASF, right? And then transitioning to higher education as far as, you know, the way you navigated from being, you know, an associate professor all the way to president level.
So I guess I'd have to start pre-BASF. When I was younger, I always wanted to be either a teacher or a firefighter. And so my mom fully documents that I used to teach all of my cousins. I was a tutor. And I thought that's where I was headed. And even up until after graduate school, I called Shaw University, which is my alma mater, And after I'd graduated with a PhD in chemistry, I said, hey, you know, do you have any teaching positions there that I could pick up? And they didn't. The same professor who had taught me, you know, he was a lead professor there, and they had a few other chemists, so they didn't have any open positions. So I decided to go to corporate America. That was my second choice. Mm-hmm. And I applied for a position at BASF, and they gave it to me. But it was one of the best moves that I could ever have made. I just didn't know it at the time. And I joined corporate and went through a phased transition from a bench chemist into what is called process optimization. It's where you try to help the company make things faster, better, cheaper. I think that's the easiest way to explain it. And I was doing process optimization for the polyolefin catalyst industry. And I got to see a lot of engineers at work, how it is that they help to do process improvement. And I got to understand how corporate America really functioned and how it is that my ideas were implemented and were translated into bottom line savings. Mm-hmm. It was a great opportunity there. From there, I moved on to procurement, chemical procurement. And that word was not in my vocabulary at the time. And so I think what corporate did for me was it really broadened my business perspective. I started to go into rooms where I didn't understand the lingo. Everything was going over my head. And I was a pretty smart chemist and very eager. So it was really a new set of waters I had to navigate, where I didn't know much about what people were talking about. They were talking about contribution margins, CM1, CM2, and it was so frustrating to me to having to, you know, be muted and then go try to Google what it is that they were talking about.
Yeah.
So that continued for a while. And even when I caught on and wanted to express myself, I noticed that I was often overlooked. And I remember having to reconcile why I was being overlooked, because often I was the only woman in the room and I was wondering if I was being overlooked because of my gender. And then there were times that I wondered if I was being overlooked because of my skin color. And I started to do some self-reflecting, and I realized that I was being overlooked because they didn't feel as if I knew enough to contribute fully to the conversation. So I went to school for an MBA at Rutgers University. And by the time I started business school and they started to explain quite a bit of what I was learning in the boardroom, I think the advantage I had is that I was getting the new knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Hot off the press, business cases, and being able to socialize with other business aspirants who were being introduced to some of the same topics and were seasoned business people. That helped me to have the conversations outside of the boardroom. I could do it in the classroom where I had the freedom to ask the silliest of questions. So I gained that strength very quickly. And then I felt more bullish when it was time for me to speak. And somebody wanted to speak over me, they would have to speak very loudly because I was going to get my point made, right? So I was more assertive and more confident with what it is that I was contributing. And soon enough, they would call on me because they recognized that my input was valuable. So it was a lesson that I had to learn. Transitioning from corporate to academia didn't come directly. I did a transition to entrepreneurship first. My business partner and I, a Hamptonian, we wanted to start a hair care company. And we started it while I was in corporate. And this remains a lesson that I teach to people all the time. When you're in corporate, there's this document that you sign that mentions you're not going to start your own business. You're not going to be a competitor with the company. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few clauses that we often don't read and don't pay attention to. We just sign them to get the job. And somebody told HR that I had started the company. And they said to me, you know, Dr. DeBoy, you cannot have a company because you would be a competitor with L'Oreal. And I'm thinking, L'Oreal is not noticing me. I had started a hair care company, and their concern was that L'Oreal bought ingredients from BASF, and we didn't buy ingredients directly from BASF, but certainly after you have B2B distributors, there was somewhere along the pipeline that we may end up buying BASF products. And they felt as if they were stopping it before we became, you know, a bigger business. So they gave me a choice. They said, Tanshni, you can divest of the company and stay with BASF, or you can go on to pursue your dreams. And at the time, I made the decision to stay at BASF because I had a six-figure salary and I didn't want to take a risk. But I went home, and at the time I had, I think our daughter was about 9 months old, and I said to my husband at that time, I said, you know, what do you think I should do? And of course, he said, what any good husband would say, whatever you want to do, and I'll be there to support you. And I had made the decision that I would quit the company, but I couldn't sleep. I could not sleep. I felt sick to my stomach. I wanted to throw up. It was just, I felt like I was making the worst decision in my entire life. And so the next day I self-corrected and I told BASF, in particular the VP there, that I wanted to take the risk while I was young. And so I left and started the hair care company. And after 5 years, as part of our plan, we divested of the company when we knew it was the right time. And then during that 5 years, I transitioned to academia. I just wanted to give back to Shaw as an adjunct professor, but they asked me to serve in multiple capacities. And I can tell you the presidential journey was never in my plans, but that's how it progressed.
And I think I remember you speaking about your company. Is it called like Tea and Honey?
You got it, Tea and Honey Blend.
Okay. And so I just remember, you know, you speaking about that, but I was just always interested as far as like when you got to Shaw and you were a professor, and then just, it just seemed like it really took off from there. But yes, it was like, dang, it was just really interesting to me about that. So,
and do you have a follow-up question on it? Or do you want to speak about it?
I have a statement I want to make really quick.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of sticking out to me is the fact that, you know, when you first got, you made that transition when you were in those spaces where you felt muted or you felt like you didn't, you know, you didn't have the knowledge to speak up on things. And so you decided to go back to school
yes.
to learn more. I think that's such a, just a teaching point, because I know for me, when I first started in higher ed, there was things that they were talking about. I was like, what are y'all talking about? CAS standards, strategic plan, blueprints, like looking at,
right.
And I'm looking like, and I mind you, I'm like 27, 28. And so, yes. But I knew that higher ed was for me. I knew because I worked so many terrible jobs. I knew that this was it. And so I was like, well, I got to learn. I got to even I got to ask those silly questions. I got to find those people that are willing to teach me outside of these big meetings. And I think that's a great point. And even going back to school, I mean, I did that just so I could, you know, make myself more presentable, make myself more desirable as you move up, because you have, and now when I hear certain languages, I'm like, oh yeah, I know what they're talking about. It's amazing because you work in a field and it becomes second nature to you. But
that's right.
That's interesting to hear you say that, because I know where you're at now. So to hear you say that is comforting.
Oh, for sure. And that's the thing about people who are coming into a new industry, or even seasoned people who are in the industry but have not taken the opportunity to learn new things. That part is the saddest part for me, because there's so much that's happening, you know, in our fields. And I think we owe it not only to our students, but even to the organizations that we serve, to constantly be learning. And that learning may not be within the organization. It may be in online tutorials. It may be at conferences. It may be speaking with a mentor. But I think part of my curiosity and why I consider myself to be a forever learner in the classroom of life is because I get curious when I hear new terms and I want to use them, right? But I want to use them in the right context. And I get curious when I hear new concepts. Just recently, I went to a conference. It was a treasurer's conference. And they invited CFOs, and they decided that they were going to invite the COO of Howard. And I'm thinking, man, you guys should be inviting our CFO. And so they asked me to present on a few financial metrics and operations of the university and how we've used innovation to spark process optimization. And I just went into my own toolbox and I did a presentation for them. I think the treasurer of Princeton was a fellow panelist. And both of us carried weight and we were able to demonstrate how we both contributed to the bottom line at our universities. He mentioned one thing that I was curious about, and it was robotic process automation. Mm. And since then, I've taken it back to our campus and I'm like, listen, we are going to do RPA, right? But that's how I believe that as leaders, we should challenge our organizations. I have something in my team meetings that I always say, and it's called what's after next. So we have a period in our team meetings where after we go through our reports, it's our what's after next segment. And I'm saying to the team that I'm not interested in solely learning about or discovering what's next. I want to know what's after next. What is it that we are going to introduce to the world that they've not yet seen? Or what is it that we're going to introduce to the campus that they've not yet seen? We're not a Me Too organization. We've got to go beyond that. So right now the team is working on how we will incorporate RPA in our enrollment management space, for example. And I won't stop until we do it.
It's awesome.
That's all. At Shaw, you had what? I think it was like the first enrollment in 6 years. Like,
that's right.
How did you go about that at Shaw doing that? I know this is off the wall question. I was just
So I'll start first by saying it took a team. We did not have a VP for enrollment management when I assumed the position of presidency. Yet, enrollment management was one of the areas that we needed to strengthen. And so the first thing that I did was I hired an AVP for enrollment management that served to coordinate activities in admissions, financial aid, the bursar specifically, but also enrollment management systems. And that deals with the IT infrastructure and the analyst infrastructure to help support that. And of course, customer service. And after doing that, it helped those teams to coordinate in a much better manner. Admissions started to understand what financial aid needed to do in order to enroll and matriculate a student. And financial aid started to understand what recruiting a student was like. And of course, in the bursar's office, they got to understand the timetable for communications that are needed in order to help with the payment of information, payment of bills, pardon me. And so once we did that, we were able to have a more robust recruitment strategy. And we helped to use technology to drive that process. Smartphone technology was used. Our students would say that they didn't get a response from the admissions office when they emailed. And so we made the system more responsive, that even if a human was unable to respond to the question that the student had, we had an automated response, not with, I'm out of the office and I won't be able to contact you until 48 hours, nothing like that. Something more intelligent that picked up on words that the student had typed and then would send them something more fitting of the response that they needed. And that would give the admissions counselor some time to be responsive. So with that type of outreach, the amount of applications that we had more than quadrupled, and then in turn, the yield that we had was pretty significant. So we were able to turn around the enrollment there for freshmen. It was beautiful to see because it's, especially at smaller universities, and at large ones too, but at smaller universities, it's lifting the enrollment for freshmen, FDIC, it's really an indicator of how well the university is doing. Right. I remember some of the naysayers, they would email us every single year to say, hey, how many freshmen did you bring in? And so I remember that year they didn't email us because they knew that we'd done a good job. But so the detractors didn't want to give me the joy of responding to say, thank you for asking, by the way. Right. But that's why it's so important for your work to be done to meet the outcomes that you've already laid out and not the outcomes that people have laid out for you. I tend to focus on doing so in my career. I don't pay attention to the haters. I often hear what they say because somebody carries that news, but it's not something that blocks my blessing or prevents me from being successful.
I know that's right.
Can I get an amen?
When somebody says something like that, you gotta say something. You kind of talked about it, but what have been some of the biggest challenges you faced as you made your way through higher ed?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, my mom, if you were to see her today, you would think that she's in her 50s, okay? So I'm old.
Did you say that?
I am older than I appear, okay? And so I've been in rooms where, because I look so young, you know, people underestimate not only the knowledge that I currently have, but the what I've been exposed to professionally. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I often am underestimated. And I've become so accustomed to it. It didn't start yesterday. It's been going on for a while now. But I think you get accustomed to that when you're very motivated, driven, and when you have a track record for success. So it also comes with its unfair share of criticism, because there were times, especially in my leadership at Shaw, where if I made what one would deem as a mistake, it was blamed on my youth. And so, you know, instead of maybe a bad decision or poor judgment, and very often there was some misogyny inserted in that. And so I think when I think about what I've had to overcome, you know, there are some systemic cultural barriers that I've had to break pretty often. I, you know, I'm a very opinionated and strong, I guess those are the words that you would use to describe the type of woman that I am, but I'm compassionate and empathetic. And I also love to, you know, motivate my team so that we can all be successful. And I noticed that in several aspects of my career, I've had to demonstrate that exceptionally so that the critics weren't right. And it takes a lot of energy. I remember there were times when I wanted to be upset and I wanted to demonstrate that I was upset about something, but I knew the risk to my leadership. If you're upset about something when you are young and a woman, your anger automatically becomes described as being young and petty, or, you know, young and we know the other term, right? And so I had to often walk out of rooms where I was upset about an outcome, and then walk into the boardroom and smile. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the weirdest things to do in terms of placating one's emotions. Yeah. And having to transition emotions so quickly because you don't even get an opportunity to feel, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think though that poker face that one has to maintain, you have to find an outlet at some point in time of how to, you know, be human. And I think that outlet still remains my daughter, right? She's my biggest psychiatrist. So, you know, but I think it is important for people to cater to their mental health and have some type of coping mechanism when you have these significant leadership positions. Because, you know, even with students, the same students that love on you and appreciate you, they will trash you tomorrow.
Bruno, you quit
on social media, right? You make one decision that they're not in agreement with, And they'll do that. But I've also come to understand that, that their emotions are often very fleeting. So that's why I ensure that I don't put a vested amount of energy in any one person's emotions, because they move on quickly. And so as a leader, I've learned to do that, to, I'd say, pocket emotions in one particular corner and not bring them along with me. But it does take some bourbon at times. And certainly, you know, paying attention to one's own health.
And you were 34, right?
When
you
yes.
President of That's Shaw right. University.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what in the world? I mean, that's, I just can't, that is like unbelievable to me that, not that, I mean, I just met you today and you're,
right.
you're very impressive. Don't get me wrong. I'm thinking at 34, mm-hmm. that kind of responsibility, how do you deal with that? And I know I just heard a little bit of your story. I just couldn't imagine right. that type of, I mean, pressure, right? I mean, yeah.
For sure. I mean, there's some kind of craziness that goes with saying, you know, I think I can do this, right? So there's some amount of, I'd call it courage. That it takes to assume a leadership position of that kind. But it's not uninformed courage. There are people who are courageous but do not have the skill set. And those are the people I worry about, because you know, I see some of some young aspirants who want to become college presidents, but I often tell them it is important for you to have a track record of success. Learn how to manage people and learn how to have broad shoulders. But at the end of the day, you have to know finances and you have to understand how the university works in order to be a good college president, because not all college presidents are created equally and not all universities are created equally. And so if you want to do good and you're not solely in the academic arena, for self-benefit, and you actually want to improve the sector, then you've got to come to the table with an ample skill set that is fitted to the university that you're going to lead. A smaller university often comes with its fair share of complexities and a different type of complexity related to the skill set needed to become a college president. Shaw in particular, every college president at Shaw has to close a budget gap each year via fundraising. And I knew that I had a gap that I had to close, but I did not necessarily have experience in fundraising. When I was being interviewed, they said to me, hey, you know, you don't have any experience in fundraising. And sure, I may not have an experience in academic fundraising, but I was a salesperson, so I had to sell Tea and Honey Blends products. And I knew that I had to raise capital for Tea and Honey Blends, which I had done successfully. But so I knew that I could take the salesperson skill set and adapt it to raising money. But I also recognized that fundraising was an art and a science, and I needed a VP for development who would assist me in that charge. And so I hired someone who was better than me. And so through our teamwork, we were able to accomplish the development feats that we did for the university.
I remember we were at Health, and I can remember that it felt, it was like, you know, you come into this president, you better get you a good CFO immediately.
That's right. That's right.
Everything's like,
yes.
Like
there are certain pockets of academia that I wish I could start a development camp for, meaning talent development, because there is a dearth of financial aid directors. It's a skill set that is highly important on any college campus, but it significantly needs to be developed in the entire arena. Excellent financial aid directors are few and far in between, and I've met a few that are dynamite, but I've also met many more that are not as good. And then Certainly, the CFO's responsibility is so significant, especially at HBCUs. And that is a skill set that needs to be developed as well. Somebody who is a great accountant or who is great in finance in corporate doesn't automatically to translate to somebody who will be great as a CFO in the academic setting. And it's because academia presents its own unique set of financial areas. For example, grants management. If you are in corporate, you may not necessarily be managing funding from various federal agencies or funding from a philanthropic partner. And it has its own gap rules. And if you're not aware of it and you're not understanding how it is that federal financial aid and Title IV aid is accounted for, you can get the university in trouble very quickly. So knowing the statutes and understanding when financial aid needs to be returned to the federal government, the policies and procedures associated with doing so, those are all intricacies in academia that, you know, may not present itself elsewhere. So it's something that, you know, we should be developing on our campuses.
And I'm from Raleigh, the area. So I remember, you know, just the whole kind of vibe shift that you had at Shaw. And so at what point, I feel like there had to be something to where you kind of looked around the table and you're like, you know what, I could run this. What that was just like, man, let me go ahead and just take control.
Well, so I'm going to give you the honest deal. From the time I entered Shaw to the time I became president, it was a 5-year period. That's unusual, okay? But I will say that there were people who believed in me and sent me along that trajectory. I started wanting to be an adjunct professor. And the dean at the time hired me and said, can you come on as a full-time chemistry professor? And I said, sure, because I really wanted to teach, as I'd mentioned before. But at the same time, I had tea and honey blends. And so I had to make sure that I was always tending to my company's needs. And they promised me that I could do both. And so I did. After being there for 3 months, they wanted me to be the department chair. I didn't know what a department chair was, didn't know what they did, but in my servant type of leadership, I said, sure, anything for Shaw. And it meant that I was now actually chair of the natural sciences and math department, not just the chemistry department. So now I had many more professors and many more disciplines that I had to pursue that chairmanship for. It was math, chemistry, biology, physics, environmental science. Yep. And so you can imagine with all of these scientists and some of whom had taught me, it was pretty difficult for me to corral everybody. And I wasn't 34 at the time. I was much younger than that.
Wow.
And so I did that. And as I was playing that role, the presidency opened up and an interim president was named. And I had done so many, I had led the team to do so many things on our campus that other divisions had not been able to accomplish. Our science professors were leading in every single aspect. I didn't care what it was. If they needed surveys to be completed, I would tell my team, okay, faculty, I need you to be first to complete everything. Right? It was just, that's how it is that I wanted to make sure that the outcomes were demonstrated. So I'd already created a track record on campus, you know, Dr. DeBroy is going to get it done and that kind of thing. So it's really about competing with yourself, because nobody on the campus was paying attention to us as we were completing surveys first, right? There's no competition, there's no prize, but it's just a matter of leading and understanding why they needed the data. So I knew that we needed to give our institutional research staff the data so that they could help to collate it and help us to make informed decisions. So I would ensure that my team did that, and they pursued it. And then when it was time, when the interim leader was named, they also made me special assistant to the president to lead a process optimization effort. So it came back to what I had already studied in corporate America. Having an MBA and having the PhD in chemistry helped to cement that skill set. And I, if you're asking, Drew, when it is that I thought I could do the job, it was after seeing what the position called for. Being able to analyze the balance sheet, being able to understand how the different parts of the machine worked together to help the university to be run. I knew the problems that Shaw had. In Shaw's case, we had a marketing problem, and I knew we needed an ambassador for the university, and we needed to increase enrollment. And I felt bullish about both. I felt that we could increase the enrollment, and I felt that I could help to change the brand. Remember, my degree is in marketing. So, and I had done Tea and Honey Blends marketing. You know, it was something that was intuitive. So with that in mind, I felt as if I could take on the job. The other piece of the puzzle that I felt I could do but didn't have necessarily a track record of doing was fundraising. And so I was able to prove that. But as I mentioned, I hired somebody who was exceptional in her field, and together we blew it away.
Did you play sports by any chance?
Yes. So I'm a swimmer. So, you know, I left it in high school. I decided that I had a long way to go for college. So I didn't try out for college sports because I knew I needed to do the PhD, and I knew it would take a very long time. So I completed college in 3 years because I was way beyond a bachelor's. I was like, all right, I know I'm getting a bachelor's. The bachelor's degree was in my way. And so I had already been calculating how many years I needed to spend in school, what I needed to do. And so I zipped through it. And if it could have taken me 2 years, I would have, right? But I just knew that my goal was the PhD. And so I kept my eyes on that.
I asked you that because the way you're talking about competing, I'm like, wait, that's how I think. I know that's how Drew thinks. And so we all talk about on this platform how our biggest message to student athletes is if you play sports, after you finish, you just find something you're passionate about and use that same mindset and apply it. And what you were talking about was competing. Like, nobody's checking for that. It's kind of like when you're working out, nobody's looking.
You're doing
these sets and you're doing 100, 200 sit-ups, or you're doing those extra laps swimming. And then you get that job, you find, like, I love this. I'm just going
to exactly.
Everybody. It's the same.
That's right. It's the winning attitude, And it's not winning without empathy. Right. Or winning where you're in a blind spot and, you know, you don't bring anything to the table, but you think you can win. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that intrinsic motivation that one has, that no matter what the challenge is, you're going to do your best at it. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that you won't make mistakes. And it doesn't mean that you will achieve a goal every single time you set out to do it. But I think the attitude that one brings to the table of the I can attitude, it really helps. And I translate that into the power of having a positive spirit. Mm-hmm. So for me, I have ended friendships because of negativity. Mm. It's easy.
That's an
email. I mean, I have no issues with just blocking people's numbers. If you are coming to me with too much negativity, I'm just done. So it doesn't mean that I'm in malice with you. It's just that you're not about to bring that energy to my table every day. And so even people who have not believed in me, I've had to give them a rest sometimes, because along my journey, you can imagine when you have a young person who is speaking with such ambition, that there have been times where people who have longer careers and have accomplished similar success but it's taken a longer time, they may not necessarily believe that a young person can do that. So I had to block out that noise and ensure that I understand that I've been given a different type of mission. And, you know, my mission and my purpose may not be yours. You're given a different purpose. And all I have to focus on is fulfilling mine. But I'm cognizant of the fact that I've not been able to do anything that I've accomplished without people. Mm. So every part of the success that I've had, it's because I have been able to work with teams and motivate them to be successful. So yes, I've been given a leadership ability, but being an empathetic leader is such a significant piece in that.
Yeah, you going back to what I learned in school, that transformational leadership, because you're using mm-hmm. that empathy a lot. And I think some leaders get it twisted. I've seen leadership not be vulnerable and not, or you know, let empower other people to right. do things, because they, in their mind, I have to be the one. I have to be the one with the ideas.
And right.
You know, people like that are so insecure. I'm sure you've met millions, tons of people that have just been insecure because of what you bring to the table at such a young age. And so me and Drew talk right. about it all the time. And it's like, you know Drew, and he's so easygoing, and that's why we get along, because we're the same. But mm-hmm. if you're not secure with yourself, when we show up and like everybody's gonna like us just because, not everybody, you know, you're gonna have some haters. But,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, people like you, and you know you can talk, and you just have that you know good attitude, as you're talking right. about. Then you work hard and you get things done. People are looking at you like, why are you trying to? It's a competition to them in a different way.
That's right. You know, my mom says it best. She taught me about disarming people because of every reason that you just described, Julian. There are times when people have never even met you and they don't like you. And I've never been able to understand that, right? And I'm like, man, how is that even possible? But, and people are jealous of so many different things, just the energy that you bring to the table, the fact that other people like you, right? And so it's a silly thing, a silly concept, but it's real. Yeah. And so I think when she speaks about disarming people, what she's saying is bring so much positivity and bring so much joy to the table that the person who has an issue with you can't help but overlook the initial barrier in order to embrace you. So, you know, it's simple. I'll give you a simple example, and it may sound trivial, but I use it all the time. So my mom and I, we were in Macy's, we were in New York when I was younger, and she wanted to return an item. And we were standing on one line that was being serviced by three cashiers. So it'd be a one line, and each cashier would mention that you could present to them. And she whispered to me and she said, I don't want that cashier on the end. I'm just like, okay, mom, why don't you want that cashier on the end? You know, I'm halfway, don't care. I just want to get out of the line. And she says, she looks like no, right? And what she meant by that was, she looks as if she's going to tell us no for this return, that we can't return it. Good. And she had no way. Obviously, she's being judgmental. The poor chick probably had a poor disposition, no smile on her face because she had a long day. But for her, that did not indicate the type of energy that she needed to see in order to make her return. And so when the young lady called on us, she told the other person to go ahead. She's like, no, you can take our spot. You go ahead, right? And she went to the person who she felt looked like yes. And we made our return. And for my mother, that's just validation, right? that, yep, this person looks like yes, that person looks like no. So the other thing that she does in terms of disarming people is she starts with a compliment. Mm-hmm. So sometimes to put a smile on someone's face, you can start with, you know, I love your hair. or hey, how you doing? Did anybody tell you you look beautiful today? Or whatever it may be. And I promise you, it just changes people's dispositions immediately. Because in this type of world, we don't slow down to say those things anymore. We go up to counters and we start with what problems we have instead of trying to figure out how somebody else's day was. So if as leaders, we can think in a more selfless manner, I think it puts us at a cut above the rest. Currently, during the pandemic, there are times when I email my entire leadership team and I say, hey, it's almost 12 o'clock, meaning noon. Everybody take a break. Go get something to eat, get off the Zoom, go water the plants, go do this, go do that. And I can't tell you how many times that I've done that I get responses saying, Dr. Roy, thank you. My doctor said I should eat more healthily. Dr. Roy, thank you. I was just so overwhelmed and your email reminded me to take a break. You know, so there are a few of us in this world who are blessed with not only the opportunity to lead, but the aptitude and the attitude to lead. And I think we owe it to those who we lead to be the best leaders that we can possibly be. And some of that is innate, but other times it has to be learned.
It's just so crazy to hear you say these things, because Kate and I, we just talk all the time just about that positive spirit, that energy. You know the landscape so well, just here at the HBCU culture, as far as you want certain things done, but you know what? They're not gonna respond to the email or that phone call. I just walk right over to the office. Hey, how you doing today? And then you get so much more done just by just being a good person overall. So that's just, it's just great to hear that from you, because it's like, dang, we talk about this all the time.
Yeah,
we do. So can you discuss some of the innovative ways, strategies that you found to be successful within higher education?
So let's see. There are a few things. I'll talk about operations first. I'm constantly trying to figure out how it is that we use technology to help inform our decision making. And I use the word inform instead of drive, because tech can't take over, right? There's a human element that we should always ensure it remains intact, especially as we relate to multiple generations on our campus. And so what we've done on our end is we have looked into technology that helps to make our enrollment management processes in particular more efficient and more user-friendly. And we want to ensure that we're always reaching out to the customer with information even before they ask us for it. So I think one of the things that we've been able to do is just having a platform that helps our students to see how far along the track are they. These are responsive platforms that are specific and customized to a particular student, and we have a longer way to go. I'm looking for customized financial aid packages. That's next on the horizon for us, that we're not just saying to everybody, here is what a sample financial aid package looks like, but it's high TASHNY based on your family's expected family contribution and your grades and your need. Here is the financial package we've created for you. And there's a video that walks through that. So we're looking into doing things like that now and helping the process to be even better than what it is, because I'm laser focused on making this exceptional. And we have quite a few tools at play to be able to do so. As far as our ERP is concerned, that's our enterprise resource planning instrument. We were using three ERPs at Howard. We were using PeopleSoft, Banner, which is an Ellucian product, and Lawson at the hospital. So now we are we've done an RFP and we're moving to Workday for that. But I mention it because there's so many of our universities who are bound to an ERP that is not doing 21st century functionality that we need in order to be successful. So sometimes the tools themselves are the issue. And if we improve those tools, we can, you know, get a more significant result. Even in the philanthropic space, I remember when I was introduced to Blackbaud, you know, without Blackbaud, we were not even getting the type of intelligence about our donors that we needed. And some of our universities can't afford those type of instruments. But when you invest in them and you reprioritize to invest, it results in you gaining so much more in philanthropic input that you get a net return on that investment, right? And so introducing the type of analytical and data analytical tools that are needed in order to help with getting the university's intelligence to be more robust, those are all types of things we're introducing into the system. And I would want to touch on sustainability as well, because in our facilities space, we are revamping our steam plant at Howard. And when we do that, it is going to reduce our carbon footprint significantly. It is probably the most significant project from an infrastructural perspective on our university's campus right now. And facilities falls under my purview. And so we are working with a third party company, ENGIE, in order to accomplish that. But it's no easy feat. We're doing a demo on a steam plant now so that we can get the new plant built. But it will help us to create our own power. And so I think that's part of the innovation we're bringing to the table. Of course, in the buildings, we have LEED certified buildings that we've built on our university's campus. And for at least three of our deals, we've done what's called a P3, or privatization, public-private deal with entities that allow us to keep the debt off our balance sheet.
Right.
So it frees up some money that university can use in the interim to you know, do other improvement projects and then do a long-term lease with a partner so that students can be served in a more efficient manner. So I think, you know, if we touch on those are some of the what we're bringing to the table. And then, you know, how it has healthcare in terms of the hospital. We're ensuring that especially Black people are benefiting from our hospital and from the partnerships that we have in the community. We're building a new hospital. We gained a partnership with the district to be able to do so. It's important for our HBCUs to restate that value proposition. I know they criticize HBCUs for not telling our story. I don't buy into it. That's not the reason people aren't investing. They're not investing because they've intentionally underinvested in HBCUs. And we're seeing some of that play out now in for the public in the nation. And so I'm hoping that as incidents with Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, as we see those types of injustice that are done over and over again to people of color, and in particular to Black people, that now we will see some of the resources that we need redistributed to us, because we've been stating this for a very long time. So for resources to be opening up now, and for our HBCUs like Spelman and Morehouse and Howard to be getting record donations, it didn't have to start now. It could have started 10, 15, 20, 100 years ago, right? We're not doing anything significantly differently. We've been graduating students, and we have been serving low-income students for a very long time. So the value proposition has always been clear. They know what it is, right? but it's the choice. And they were making a choice not to invest in our institutions. So we're getting some traction now, and I'm just hoping that traction not only translates to what I would call the Big Ten, but also translates to our smaller HBCUs, because we need them too.
That's just so crazy, because I know this is a little off topic, but it kind of gets us to our next question. I think Ms. Bostic is her name.
Yes.
So I was talking to her last week, and she was just like, oh yeah, Dr. DeBroy, she's great. You know, she's a problem solver. You know, she's not you, but she's gonna take that issue. Okay, how can I work this? And so with everything going on, right, we're talking about reopening schools, reopening universities. How do you look at that? Like, of course, we're keeping everyone's safety. That's first. But how do you look at it? Like, we could really kind of come out on top on this thing, like to take advantage of it and make it like work out best for Howard in the long run. Do you have any like ideas or something that comes to mind or anything like that?
You know, I don't know anybody who wants to be in academia at this time leading this kind of charge, right? I certainly did not sign up for COVID-19. However, you know, I think this is where having broad shoulders comes into play and being a leader for our time comes into play. You know, I don't know if I would describe it as Howard coming out on top. But I do think that it can be described as a leader now has to understand all of the ramifications of decision making, the risk that is being taken on when we go in one direction or the other. It may seem like it's such an easy decision to go online fully or to have a campus footprint, but every single decision has its fair share, unfair share, pardon me, of ramifications. Even if you go online, you still have to think about retention of those students, right? As you can imagine, in a student affairs environment, now we're having to think about how do we engage students when they're in their living rooms to ensure that that following academic year, not only are they successful academically, but they come back to the campus. And you also have to do that while thinking about faculty members that you may have to cut from and staff that you may have to cut because the finances just won't support an online model. That's if you're not built for an online model, it's going to be very difficult for you to operate within that realm. And an online education, one of the reasons why we do have campus footprints is because you have to be able to deliver that well. And not all universities are suited to do so well. Even though you may have the infrastructure to do so, what the professor delivers may differ significantly because they have academic freedom and not all professors are as tech savvy as others. So it certainly comes with quite a few elements that one has to think about when deciding what direction to go. At Howard, we've described a hybrid model because we have a medical school, dental, nursing school, and they each have their own accrediting bodies. And the accrediting bodies have already told us that a nurse can't graduate without having her or his clinicals, right? And so we have to ensure that we are teaching face-to-face for some of our students so that they can go into the professions of their choice. Medical students are already on our campus because they have to do rounds, right? Mm-hmm. So they're considered to be part, it's not essential personnel. These are essential students, if there's ever such a term to coin, right? But they understand that it's part of their development and they wanted to be back on campus and we had to adjust so that we could facilitate them. Same thing for dental students. You do not want a dentist who has never operated on a live person, right? You don't want a simulation dentist, right? So you know, at a university like Howard, we have those types of fields and we offer those disciplines. It certainly has a different type of and a different layer of decision-making associated with that.
I try to find like a bright spot, right? And so I was like, we'll start in August after Thanksgiving, the semester's over.
You know, if I have to find a bright spot, I would talk about community. Because I always say that we talk about Black excellence a lot, right? And when our family, meaning the university community, isn't doing something that I consider to be excellent, I'm like, this is not Black excellence, right? and so I think when we say that we're doing a hybrid and a certain percentage of the student body needs to come back to campus, they need to wear their masks. They need to sanitize. They need to ensure that if they are presenting with a fever, that they don't come to class. I think this is how we now demonstrate Black excellence, that we're saying we know that our community is genetically and environmentally predisposed to certain health conditions. And because of that, we are going to take care of us. Right. So our ability to control the spread would be a demonstration of that Black excellence. And if we can manage to have that as our narrative, I think that would be the brightest spot that we could hope for.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely, it'll, when you hear stuff like that, you go, okay, we could do this, kind of like gathering. it's so crazy because I remember even when you were at Shaw and that you're at Howard, you see so much stuff online. You seem to have like a great relationship, you know, with students. You know, you're accessible to them. I saw one time you like host a volleyball game one time at Howard, like steps in to do that. But I heard you talk one time and you just referenced something like your tone and your tenor as far as a situation that happened. But with this generation of students specifically, like how do you make sure that you're just like that constant communication to where nothing's lost, to where they feel a certain way? Because like you said earlier, we just took a picture together. Now you're just dogging.
Exactly. So, you know, I absolutely enjoy communicating, teaching, befriending. And I say that from an adult student type of relationship. And learning more about students and their families. I like learning about their circumstances because it also helps to inform what I do as a university leader. I fully recognize that I can't put students in boxes, and you can't assume that everybody has a secure internet connection. You can't assume that everybody's safe at home. You know, when we're telling students, you're safer at home, go home. Not safe at my house, right? Those are just real circumstances that a student may face. So that's why I am always trying to figure out who our students are. And that requires me to stay in touch with them. So when Coach K asked me to help, you know, be the coach of the day, oh, that is right in my wheelhouse, right? I get to talk smack and, you know, motivate the team. Oh, it would be, and they're absolutely adorable. You know, the volleyball ladies, I give them so much respect because not only are they athletic and competitive, but at the end, they are funny, right? And they are really what I would call a cohesive team. And so when I think about how it is that students have helped me to be a better leader, it's really because of the circumstances that they have that they've expressed to me. And then that helps me to understand what type of decisions I need to make in order to ensure their voices are incorporated in it. So the love goes two ways. And that love sometimes has to translate into discipline as well. I have had many occasions where I've disciplined a student, both publicly and via email. But I have learned how to craft that email. So I will say things like, I understand that email may be the worst form of communication, but I would be remiss if as an educator, I did not talk to you about what you have placed in this email below. And, you know, and sometimes I'll tell them, I'll say, your email hurts and here's why. You know, and I, what I love about students is they are often remorseful. You know, they will say, Dr. Broy, I apologize. I did not mean to say it like that. It's very few. I remember every single email where the student has doubled down on their sassiness because it's happened so few times. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's happened maybe twice in my entire career where a student has doubled down. And when they double down, I go back again, right? I don't stop it there. I go back again. And I remember on one occasion, the student didn't respond, but then something happened and she's like, man, you didn't even talk to me like this, but this person spoke to that person like that. Right. And I'm thinking, girl, are you giving me a compliment right now? Right. This is not a compliment with your, but you still haven't apologized.
Yeah.
But it's not often. Right. And so that's why I think even with those emails, it's a way to get to know our students and their parents. Yeah. You know, we often think that, you know, students are the ones bringing the challenge to the table. I've had some challenging parents. I have a flaw where one of my many where I sometimes call people sweetheart, darling, and that kind of thing. It comes from Jamaica, right? It's like, hey, sweetheart, how you doing? And you know, it's a whole colloquial thing, a part of the culture. And sometimes I have to really curb it because I don't want people to misunderstand how I may be referring to someone. And especially in this type of environment, you have to be so careful because there are certain sensitivities that go with that. So I've learned how to control that. But I remember on one occasion, I had said to a parent who was waiting for a while at Shaw. I was a professor at the time. And I said, hi, sweetheart. I said, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to be with you shortly. And she said, do not call me sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, you know, I retreated immediately and I apologized, but you know, she elevated and she was I think probably annoyed that she was waiting for so long too. Mm-hmm. And so it could have gotten out of hand. It didn't, because I continued to de-escalate the situation. But I'm using that as an example because her poor daughter was so embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Right? And she was trying to get her mother to be quiet because, you know, she had gotten extremely loud at the time, but the child was meek and she joined my class and one of the meekest students I've ever had, right? But I won't forget the situation because it has certainly taught me that I need to be mindful of how I speak as well. So even when I may think that it's harmless, the words that I use have an impact.
I think so with Cape and I you probably have a friend like this too, like we'll call each other like, man, do you want to laugh? Like, let me tell you what this dude just did to me. And you just kind of, it helped you kind of calm down. You're like, I'm about to just kill him with kindness. And then you might and so I can't tell you how many times a student would just like, it kind of takes a little bit from your pride, but then you just.
Right. You just can't be concerned about it. I mean, I've seen professors and students go at it. Yeah. I've seen fights.
Yeah.
I have seen arguments. I have heard words thrown, but luckily I've not been involved in anything like that. And the way that I establish camaraderie with my students when I'm in the classroom, what ends up happening, I've had one situation where a student said a curse word in my class and other students were like, no, you do not do that to Dr. DeBroy, you know? So
me too. Like, that's how you know you have a good relationship.
Exactly. And she's so successful. She's now on my Facebook page, you know, complimenting, liking, and I'm doing the same. But it that's part of what it calls for when you are an educator, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be forgiving. Because at the end of the day, that you know that you are raising the next generation of leaders. And these are all teaching moments for them. You know, you're constantly telling them, okay, that's not the way, but here's what we can do differently in order to be more successful.
And that's when you crack open that bourbon too, later on that night.
I was drinking bourbon at the time, I started drinking bourbon and at an older age. I don't know who introduced me to it, but I got into it later. Now I'm a sophisticated bourbon drinker.
I started, it wasn't top shelf when I started, so yeah.
I think before Kate, I know one thing you said, I always see you, right? You always look like you want to be there. And so that's like one thing with Cape and I, we always like people watch as far as like, hey man, you don't have to be here. Like when we see like, someone doesn't want to be there. So that's like something that we always just like, you're going to know. I want to be here.
Yes. And
go from there. But that was one thing I always noticed about you. You always look like you were having the time of your life and you were in that.
Oh, that's important. I think presence is important. You got to stay in the room.
Because somebody's always watching. At the end of the day, I think people get so content. Like, they've been there so long. They're like, they'll show up in whatever kind of attire or feel like they can say anything and be the negative Nancy.
Yes.
And somebody's always watching. I like to think that the reason you moved up so quickly is because even when you might have thought nobody was watching, they were watching you, even from afar or close up, and they trusted you enough to say, she's ready. At 34, yes, she's ready to do
this. That's true. I forever remain grateful for that. And I mean, you know, I attune to blessings in the first part of our talk, but I'll be honest with you. I remain a Christian and I'm very spiritual. I won't say I'm the model Christian, don't get me wrong. You know, I err just like everybody else, but at the same time, the type of respect and relationship that I have for my Savior, that also helps, right? So I'm constantly thinking, not necessarily how can I progress, but I don't make a move unless, you know, I feel as if I've heard from the Lord. So I'm always asked, you know, what's next? And I'm like, I haven't heard what's next yet. They're like, from who? Right? So, but it's just part of how I operate. It's as if it's just part of me that before I make the next move, I'm going to ensure that, you know, this is ordained, you know, because I feel as if I'm walking in that purpose, then I'll have the success that I'm seeking.
Absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned it earlier, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor. What were your initial thoughts? Like, you know, what was going through your mind and what emotions did you kind of range? What kind of range of emotions did you have?
I mean, you know, anger, tears. I think I've been through them all. And the unfortunate part was that this wasn't the first time that I was experiencing that. But it took me a while to watch the entire George Floyd video, especially after I'd seen what Ahmaud went through. And Breonna Taylor's story didn't hit my timeline until a bit late.
Like,
after she'd already been killed. So you can imagine the frustrations had already started, you know, Trayvon Martin. And then, you know, Philandra Castile, we can name all of the people who have faced police brutality and have died at the hands of police. So those emotions never go away. It's always an emotion that we carry and we try to do something about where we can. So to see that what Ahmaud went through, and then to have it punctuated with George Floyd, that was just, you know, overwhelming. And the worst part about it was hearing him cry for his mother. And when I watched it, I didn't know his mother had already passed. So you can imagine, as a mother, and yes, I don't have a son, but I am sister to several brothers. I am a daughter to my father, you know, and niece to my uncles. And as I saw that, it really tore on my heartstrings. So I think, you know, in my everyday living, I try to be an advocate and a voice, not only on social media, but also face-to-face in terms of who I meet, not only on a daily basis, but also professionally. And I remember after the incidents, I gave my team a moment of gratitude where I specifically reached out to the Black men on the team just to tell them thank you, you know, and to give them a chance to just breathe, because so many times we put so much on the shoulders of our Black men and we have stereotypical expectations of them when they're made up, you know. Not everybody is going to be the ideal head of household. It just doesn't work like that. And so I think we have to undo some of those stereotypes, and then we have to get down into the systemic issues that continue to keep us down as a people. And so I'm optimistic because I'm serving a campus where we have the ability to impact who goes where. We have the ability to impact judges, Black judges in the Supreme Court systems and in the lower districts and beyond. And we have the ability to, and we have impacted medical doctors around the globe. And that rings true for the arts. Don't underestimate what it is that the HBCU family that are in the performing arts can do for our universities. They can continue to shine light on our universities like they have done. I know that very often we see Howard highlighted, but I've seen Morehouse too, right? and I've seen Hampton and Spelman highlighted. And that's what we have to continue to do. And then I think, you know, I love the protests. I love what I'm seeing nationwide, globally. That just melted my heart because I always say not everybody can be a frontline soldier, and not everybody should be a frontline soldier. But we do need the frontline soldiers out there. And sometimes it takes the chaos to disrupt the system. So I think that all levels of activation are needed. We're going to need the Michelle and Barack Obamas of the world, where we are not able to go into the rooms that they can access, and they need to have the conversations there. And as leaders of corporations, we need to ensure that they're having those conversations and making changes where they can. And at the HBCU levels, we need to ensure that the leaders that we're sending out into the world are robust, and that we're teaching them about this moment and how to constructively disrupt the moment. Because our young people need not only to be taught about the history, but how it is the current system works and what it is that we really need to do in order to make a difference. Because sometimes, you know, they activate, but they don't do it with the intelligence of the elders, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't realize what has happened before or what the symbolism means. And we see a lot of social media noise, but they haven't researched whether something is real or not. You know, so those are just some of the ways I think that various generations need to be working together to help to strategize on where we go next.
That's just, I remember seeing that George Floyd, and Cape and I were talking that day, and it was just like, man, we were already super paranoid anyway when we like were driving and stuff. Like,
oh, for sure.
I always like, I just hear my dad's voice like, don't nothing good happen past 10 p.m., son, where you go? It's just like, you got like mental checklist if you do get over or something like that. So just to see that happen, you're like,
that's right.
He wasn't fighting back. He wasn't doing anything.
That remains heartbreaking. It's just that one, you know, and that case isn't over as yet. You know, right. We've got a long way to go to wrap that up. And so I'm looking forward to the convictions.
Likewise. So who were some of your mentors who poured into you, and what was the best piece of advice you received from them?
So you can imagine women in the chemistry field. I didn't see women mentors for a very long time. But my high school mentor remains the lady who is responsible for me getting into the field of chemistry. I can tell you when I started chemistry, I hated it. And I was like, why do we have to know what a mole is?
Me too.
I didn't understand the concept. I was gonna get it. I could not get it. My friends got it. They were doing the calculations, and it was so frustrating for me because I didn't understand the concept of a mole. And I remember maybe I was about 14 at the time, or 13, I went into various books and I started looking up what a mole was. And so many of them got it, you know, it was still abstract. But then I went into one particular book and it said a dozen is 12 items. And then it went into a baker's dozen is 13 items. Mm-hmm. And a mole is 6.02 times 10 to the 23 items. And for whatever reason, it was just explained so simply that I could understand it as a volume of something, right? And so because of that, I started looking at it. Okay, so 12 donuts, 13 donuts, 6.02 times 10 to the 23 donuts, right? And just like that, my light bulb went on. And I mastered the concept of a mole, and believe it or not, I took off from there. So I always credit my high school chemistry teacher with laying that foundation. My parents are street entrepreneurs. I mean, they're serial entrepreneurs. They continue to own farms back home, and they have parlayed in so many industries. My mom in particular was in the restaurant industry, the hair industry, meaning salon, and she did catering. So I got to see her in motion, try things, fail, do this, do that, in and out, and, you know, bar capital, payback capital, all of these types of foundations, just for practical business operations. I got to see that from a very young age. And so I'd say my parents are certainly and continue to be my mentors. Then as far as professional mentors were concerned, I had a few mentors and a few sponsors. In corporate, I had a mentor that, or rather a sponsor that helped me to traverse BASF. He was from London, and he'd been to Jamaica a couple of times and everything, and, you know, was very intrigued with how it is that I was so young but able to come into corporate and do so well. And so he helped me there. And I can't forget my mentor at NC State University. His name was Dave Schultz, and Dave really helped because I had joined a graduate group, and I would never see my graduate advisor. He would take the stairs all the way from the first floor to the ninth floor because he didn't want to see anybody on the elevator. We called him Batman, and I wouldn't see Batman. He never did any weekly meetings with us. And he favored the blonde white men in the group. And I say blonde my white men because we had dark-haired white men in the group, and he never paid any attention to them either. So it was only the blonde guys, and he was blonde, and it was just this blonde fete that they would have all the time. And so I wasn't learning anything. I was like, this is ridiculous. And he had the most amount of money at the university as far as grant money was concerned. And so I met Dr. Schultz, and he had a more conservative amount of funding, but decided to take me on in his group. And I asked him to join his group because he was one of my favorite teachers. He taught spectroscopy, and he taught spectroscopy so well. I had never seen anybody teach such a complex subject and break it down into layman's terms so easily. And so a large part of what I do in my teaching is mimicked from Dr. Schultz's method of teaching. And it works so well for students. I can see when the light bulbs continuously go off, you're like, oh, that's what right? Because that's what that meant, right? And I teach chemistry as a new language, because I realized that, you know, it is like learning Spanish or something foreign, you know? Mm-hmm. And so those were mentors there. Finally, by the time I was exiting grad school, I had a female mentor at that level. And she was an engineer, Dr. Christine Grant, but also at NC State. And she also helped not only as we were exiting grad school, but also beyond. And she remains one of my favorite people. From the college president perspective, Dr. Dorothy Yancey and Strickland, Haywood Strickland, he was down by Wiley. Those are people that I just love talking to. Not only are their jokes hilarious, their stories transcend time, okay? Those are bigger than life stories. I can't wait to start presenting my stories like that, but I need some gray hair first, right? you need some gravitas and some grays to be able to tell stories like that. But they are just such amazing connectors. And so they continue to be exceptional people in my life.
That one thing you said about your graduate advisor and just never being able to see him or just him being around, I think that's one of the things that I took with me from undergrad, where it's like I never wanted to have a student feel like they couldn't get in touch with me or
yes.
wasn't at my office hours. Like that was just, that really stuck out to me, because when you're a student, sometimes, especially in grad school, you're like, hey, I just drove 45 minutes up here. We had a
exactly. That's right.
Uh-huh. That sticks with you to make sure you don't want to do that to the
agreed.
So you said that, I was like, man, I remember that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And some of my students to this day, I'm still mentors of theirs. And some of them are able to access me more readily than others because they have my cell phone number. They, you know, text me all kinds of stuff and email me, Dark, can you look through this, please? It's due tomorrow. I don't have a whole bunch of stuff to do. But, you know, I don't think I've said no up until this moment. You know, there are times when I've missed a text or something, but it's always been, I always reply when I'm able to, just to make sure that they always have somebody that they can connect with, even in their toughest of times. Sometimes it's personal challenges that they may be having, and I've had to reserve time to help them walk through that. I remember one of my mentees, she just graduated with a degree in biomedical engineering, but she was having a tough time getting that degree, right? And, you know, I had to share some tips with her on how to navigate the PWI space that she was in. And now she has her degree. And, you know, I think we've gone through 5 times where we both quit, right? I was like, I know you want to quit, but no, right? Let's not quit. Let's just persist. So mentorship it's really, it takes a lot of work. And so that's why I ensure that, you know, I'm not just telling everybody, yes, I'll be your mentor, because it's a two-way relationship that I take seriously.
I think what Kate and I always talk at his previous institution, like that would be our biggest, like our thing, to where we felt like, oh man, that's like the best feeling, knowing that students can rely on you and to come to you for certain information.
Yes.
Like, to be about the actual course, like you said, like, oh, walk me through that. You did what? like tell me that story. Say it out loud. That doesn't sound like, does it? It's just like those moments really just create that bond. That's like the best thing I can say, like working at IRE. So
agreed.
I hear that. Yeah. So now we're at our last question. We appreciate it's been dropping gems of knowledge for us. What kind of recommendations would you have, you know, just for someone that's kind of like following your footsteps now, like just maybe like the do's and the don'ts, but just a quick like, hey, I'm just giving it to you real.
Yes. So, you know, I think I can sum it up with some of what I've already mentioned. It's important for you to bring your best self to the table. And if your best self has not yet been developed, then pour into that development. Invest in that development. And ensure that if you are a student affairs professional, that you are being the best of your game. And it is important for you to ask your leadership what that best is defined as, because from a strategic perspective, it may not be in alignment with the current university that you're serving, because that may not be their strategy. And you may think, I'm being an exceptional student affairs professional, but then if you were to check in with your leadership, they're like, I don't even see your work product, right? Or you're detracting from what it is that I'm trying to do. So, and I think that can be a cross-section of the entire enterprise. You are as good as how your manager sees you in terms of being a great fit. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate, and there are times I think that I've had to choose my manager, if that makes any sense, where I'm saying, okay, this manager is not a good leader. And I am not going to work for this person. It is better for me to find another opportunity outside of this arena. And that's just real. And there are times when you are going to have to make decisions like that instead of staying frustrated with the same manager. But self-reflection is important to ensure that you're not the problem. If you are have a track record of every single manager that you've ever, you know, worked for has the same complaint, then something's wrong with you, right? Maybe wrong with you. So you need to check that out. But investing in one's development is extremely important. I think, as I've mentioned, having a positive attitude can help in terms of outcomes and in terms of success. And when you radiate that positivity, it helps you with your team. Not only if you are a leader in that team, but you don't have to be in a leadership position to lead. So you have to be mindful of what it is that you are creating as far as a culture in your work environment is. And if your aspirations are to move up in the ladder, I always say, act like the manager. I've had friends who were seeking positions of leadership, and I've just had to tell them, male friends, put on a tie. And one of them said to me, they don't wear ties at my workplace. I was like, I don't care. Put on a dress shirt and a tie, right? And you know what is so weird? People started noticing that he had on a tie. And there were a couple other people that started doing it too. But most importantly, his boss saw a difference in him. He didn't do anything differently in terms of his work output. All he was doing was putting on a different, attire. And so I think that gave probably new insight and caused others to see him in a different light, right? But sometimes it does call for that. It calls for, you know, dressing the part and looking to see who it is that you want to be, what role it is that you want to attain, and dressing to fit that part. So, you know, those are some of the highlights that I would have. And lastly, I'd say that you should always be innovative and creative. If your creative juices are not running and you aren't trying to add value from an innovative perspective, then you're just being stagnant in your role. And so I think especially as we lead our HBCUs, I'm constantly looking to see what it is that I'm missing, right? What are the manual processes that we're doing that we should be using technology to drive? Every single person who is doing a manual process should stop and say, this is ridiculous. You know how many times I've done that with fields that I know nothing about? I ask them, why does it take so long? Dr. Bry, yes, we can get the data. How long? 1 week. No, we're on this planet, right? Unless you are trying to analyze millions and terabytes, whatever else it may be, of data, you should not be analyzing or giving me any data within a school of 9,400 students that comes back 1 week later, right? It means that there is something that is preventing us from getting data at our fingertips. And so my team right now, I just had one of those conversations with our analysts and said, you know, I don't like the idea that I am constantly saying to you, here's my problem, can you help me fix it? I want you to say to me, here are the problems that we've seen, and here's how we can help you fix it. Because so many of them have come from other institutions. They have a plethora of knowledge and they're the experts. I'm not the expert. I'm never the expert in anything that I do. They're smarter than I am. So I need you to bring that smartness to the table and help me solve those problems. So I think as young professionals, we should be thinking in that way. I'm smarter than De Bruy. Mm-hmm. Here's a problem I'm going to bring to her. But I'm not only bringing the problem, I'm bringing the solution. And I will never forget somebody who does that. You know, so those are the types of things that I think we should be doing from a professional perspective. There'll be times when, even in my current position, obviously I report to the president. And when I came on board with Dr. Frederick, I thought I was quick. This man, he did not get any sleep, does not get any sleep. And he was quick, and at times even quicker than I am. And I was like, oh, no, 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 no. This is not how it's going to be, right? So I had to do a quick analysis of him, get to understand who he is, how quick he is, what his expectations are. And I had to pick up my pace. And I'm quick. But, you know, I was like, man, you know, go to sleep, right? But he's a surgeon. And so I didn't bargain for that part. I didn't realize surgeons were up, you know, at 2. Chemists are up at 4, right? And so I've learned, you know, how to, I use the term manage my boss, but that's not what it means. It just means ensuring that you meet your boss's expectations, right? It's not a power play. It's not about trying to ensure that he is doing, you know, something that you want him to do. No, it's about understanding his expectations and working to fit those expectations. And even when he doesn't expect something, presenting that to him so that it can help him to understand that the outcomes that he's looking for are being achieved.
Man, you dropped some gems tonight, Dr. DeBrew. I definitely took a lot of notes. I got a performance appraisal tomorrow morning, so I'm looking forward to it.
Hilarious. Yep, right. Write all your accomplishments. Tell them what it is that you've contributed. You know what I do as well with that? I have a performance review coming up, but not only do I write the outcomes, but I write them under the umbrellas of the strategic plan. Right? So if I'm saying that we increased enrollment, I tie it back to the strategic pillar. So that's something that you can do just to demonstrate that you are that you are working under your strategic plan umbrella, right? Because not every employee gets that, right? That everything that we're doing is supposed to tie back to the strategy. But those are the types of ways that you differentiate yourself so that they realize you understand the big picture.
Definitely. I always, I was writing down, I was like, hold on, okay, what's the new innovative strategy we're talking about for this year? And I was on the strategic planning committee, so I was like, okay, let me go back.
That is perfect. Like, yeah, exactly.
Before you were like your manager, just kind of like not managing them, but knowing, okay, this is how they're going to react. So I'm going to hit them with this.
That's right. Always. That's why the psychology degrees help.
I got a psychology degree.
With Drew, when she said she had to do an analysis of her boss, like she. That's so true, though.
Definitely.
Her boss and be like, okay. This is how they operate. This is why things presented to them. This is the days when they want. They're usually happier. So you give them.
Exactly. Understanding human emotion, human expectations. You know, people like that are successful at relationship building, right? Mm-hmm. So all of those things are important.
Mondays and Fridays, they hate hearing bad news. So I try to at all in
there. Get them on that chicken Wednesday. That chicken Wednesday.
Everybody's happy at chicken Wednesday.
That's HBCU love right there.
All the way.
Dr. Boyd, thank you so much just for taking the time, because it really means a lot to us. And we just...
No problem. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
All right. See you, Drew. Bye, Julian. Best of luck to you.